It's like a bullshitter.
Where you have arbitrary power.
Injustice seems not far behind.
With the idea being that Ethereum would become a DAO.
Ethereum was supposed to be a DAO.
The human interaction is not solved.
I wanted to ask you about this concept of democracy.
Can't I just have everything I want all of the time? Isn't that what a democracy is?
Space Monkeys, blasting off again with Gavin Wood. He's the chief architect of Polkadot, fellowship member, rank 6, here again on the program today to talk specifically about governance. Gavin, thank you very, very much for being here and welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again.
I think governance is a really broad topic. It covers capital, reputation, nepotism, fortune, birthright, violence. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there's something very innate about it. Think about children on a schoolyard. You know, there's this authority maybe on the other end of the playground, but amongst themselves, they're able to come to a consensus. They're able to decide what to do.
I suppose it's this notion of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts. Forming a coherent group allows you to do things that you just can't do as a single individual. And oftentimes, you know, there's an eventual limit, but usually the bigger the group, at least in the early stages, the more, the greater this potentiality, the greater this improvement in what you can do. And I think this is probably, you know, clear even on the playground as an 8-year-old, like the games that you can play if you all agree to play by the rules. And the games can be more interesting. It's like even today I play cards, 2-player games of cards, not so much fun compared to 3-player, 4-player, 5-player games of cards, right? I eventually hit a limit and, you know, maybe there's too many people in the game when you get to like 9 players or something. But and it's certainly true in these early stages, like one player game of cards, solitaire, that's really not so much fun compared to like, you know, bridge or something.
Sure.
Governance is really just this, taken at its broadest sense, it's really just forming a collective that abides by some rules. Now, of course, there's questions about determining what rules they abide by, enforcing the rules, and so forth. But in principle, it's not so very much different from a game of cards.
Where do you think your interest in governance sprang from?
Very difficult to say. I barely even remember these days, you know, what I was thinking of when I was a teenager. But I certainly liked, you know, from a very early age, I think I was like 8 or 9 when I started coding. I was quite interested in like systematics and working out rule systems. I made games as a teenager, like, you know, just crappy, but, you know, multiplayer games, paper, colored pens, sort of thing, cards. Eventually, I got to the point where I could, with a friend, sort of self-publish like a strategy board game where, you know, the rules were designed. And I think a lot of it, I wouldn't like to say where in particular, you know, I became interested. I think I was always interested to some degree, just because I'm interested in, you know, the world. A big part of the world is people. It's like how people interact, systems by which people interact, how you can design them, how computers could intermediate human interaction, how they could be used for more than merely a tool to subjugate the world, but also could become a way of allowing people to interact in a new and more mutually beneficial ways between themselves.
Right.
I can certainly point to, I think, a few books. History of Western Philosophy was a nice one by Bertrand Russell, and it sort of opened my eyes to a lot of the philosophical currents of human interaction over the ages. I remember when I was, I guess I must have been late 20s, around the same time I was making this board game, I was thinking quite deeply about governance through the internet, computers, what we would now call, I guess, DAO stuff, but DAO at the level of a nation. I think I wrote up some of this stuff. I probably have it like in a file somewhere from, like, you know, 2008, something like this. But it was quite an interesting thought experiment. And I guess in part, it's also the people that I've typically hung around, like some of my old school friends, not least Aaron, who is Foundation Council President, and Al, who is the head of Web3 Research. Mm-hmm. People I went to school with, they're people that I've talked about all this stuff endlessly with, and I think they're both people interested in similar things, you know, systematics, rule sets, game theory, and so forth.
So you were saying you were building a board game in your late 20s?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was like I was maybe 28, 29.
Okay, this is a game that was published?
Self-published.
Okay, nice, nice. What was the purpose of the game?
The purpose, I mean, the situation of the game.
Okay.
Basically, you had a big field separated out in like blocks and grids, in a grid structure. You could purchase bits of the field, and they came up for sale in a random order. And then you could build buildings in the field, kind of build blocks of a city in a field. So the idea was that it was building a city from scratch. It was called Milton Keynes. Milton Keynes is a new city in the UK, built in the 60s, I think, basically on Greenfield. So there were a couple of villages around, but almost all of it was new development. Split into grids with like roundabouts at every intersection. So kind of similar to how things are, what the standard is in the US, but like in the UK, it's like everything is super historical. Like
yeah, right.
So there's a few of these new cities.
So a new city plan.
Right. Hmm. But farmers were being a bit piss annoying and like only selling their land at like, you know, in random lots throughout the game. Huh. And the interesting scoring dynamic was that it was symbiotic. So that this you know, sort of similar to how cities really work. Businesses will do better if they are neighboring other businesses, right? Hmm. Building a city that has a block over here and a block over there and a block over here, and there's like motorways between them, isn't nearly as economically viable as like a city that where it's all like neighboring blocks.
Yeah, right, right.
The bank employees can go to the sandwich shop. The sandwich shop guys can, I don't know, use the ATM. Like, it's all very symbiotic. So the scoring mechanism in the game was such that it rewarded players who built next to other players, but it also rewarded players with the larger buildings more than with the smaller buildings. So if they were the same size next to each other, they both got something. Mm-hmm. But if one of them was bigger and the other one was smaller, then the bigger one got more.
Gotcha. What sort of choices could a player make that made things go wrong?
Building something too early on. So suppose you build early on, you have smaller, you don't have access to so much of the land. So you would maybe build small buildings. Hmm. Every building gets some sort of income, generates some income. Mm-hmm. So you maybe build a small building to get a little bit of money to be able to buy more land, to be able to build bigger buildings, right?
Right.
But if you build a small building early on, the chances are that other players are going to build bigger buildings around you because they know that by neighboring you, they're going to get some additional income.
Gotcha.
So then you're going to end up being the owner of a small building, making a very small amount of income, but then all the other players are just like earning off you, which isn't so good, right? That's not gonna win you the game.
Right, right.
So maybe, you know, you'll eventually try and find a demolish card so that you can demolish your small building and use it to make a bigger building.
Wow.
But it doesn't work if you build next to yourself. It only works if you build next to other players.
That's interesting. Do you think we could dig up the rules to this game? Do they exist?
Yeah.
There's
yeah,
somewhere?
Yeah.
That's interesting. This book was The History of Western Philosophy.
Yeah.
That's right. What are some themes that ran through that concerned you about humanity? Some places where we've been that maybe things got a little bit hairy?
I mean, it didn't deal so much with the 20th century, which I think is probably where the most immediately tangible hairiness has been.
Yeah.
And most of it was pretty abstract, right? It was like, this guy said this. This guy said that. Hmm. This guy said this thing, which, if you look, is kind of like what this guy said before him, but slightly different.
Yeah.
It sort of dealt more with the broader philosophy and the currents of philosophy running through the last 3,000 years. Mm-hmm. A little bit with the personal circumstances and the broader circumstances of society in which the currents arose, but nothing too specific. It gave me some grounding on the depth of thought that others had done in and around this area. And it also helped me understand a little bit the branches of philosophy and their what has broadly been proposed within those branches. And if nothing else, it taught me that there is really no straight answers for very many of the important questions.
Right.
Which I think is actually quite useful, is a little bit relevant for governance, because it sort of implies that this isn't a solved problem, right?
Yeah, right.
Like, human interaction is not solved. The best we can do is take a good but difficult to implement idea and implement it better.
Right, the best we can.
I think, really, probably.
Are there some key elements or building blocks of game theory that you can define for us?
I mean, one avenue is, it's a very simple avenue of you have a collective.
Mm-hmm.
People have an opinion over what should be done in any given circumstance.
Mm.
But the collective is such that it acts as a whole. How do you aggregate those individual opinions into a collective action?
Sure.
And this is a hard problem. A very hard problem,
yeah.
Right? And then it's made, you've got some like properties to this. Maybe people can leave the collective if they choose. Maybe they can't. Maybe they can leave if they pay. Maybe if they leave, they get paid. Maybe it costs the collective to have a member leave.
Mm.
And each of these circumstances will alter your sort of solution, the potential solutions, and how good they are. In a country, for example, it's quite hard to leave a country. It's like you have to pack all your stuff up.
Yeah.
You have to like travel, you have to find another country to live in. You have to maybe learn a different language. It's a non-trivial undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you sell your share, if you're part of a collective in that you hold shares in a corporation, leaving as a shareholder, that's quite easy.
Sure.
Sell on the market, you buy some other. One has to understand the nature of the collective to understand the potential viability of any given solution. We might automatically sort of presume, oh, that means voting systems.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily mean voting systems. That one can imagine all sorts of other or only partially democratic systems.
Right.
And which is not to say that voting systems are wholly democratic by any stretch either. Obviously, there's like papal model where you've got a pope.
Sure, sure.
Or a monarchistic model, imperial model. You've got like dictatorial model. You've got like you've got a random dictator model where you just every day you just select someone at random. This is perfectly democratic, right? Everyone has on a probabilistic level exactly the same influence over what happens.
Interesting, right?
Right, but it's still a dictatorial model in that only one person is responsible for any given decision.
You kind of hinted in the last time we were together about a competition to create a voting system for, what was it, the UK Parliament or something like that?
Yeah.
What was that all about?
So this is going back to, I think, 2008-ish.
Okay.
Reforming the voting system became a thing.
Mm-hmm.
The reason, in part, it became a thing was because while normally a two-party system, briefly, it became a three-party system. The third party, Liberal Democrats, managed to score enough of the parliament that they become, you know, not merely kingmakers for a hung parliament, but actually they had a substantial, I think it was like 25, 35, 40. So they actually had a substantial portion of the votes.
Hmm.
And of course, in a first-past-the-post system, it's wildly disproportionate. So while they had, you know, a quarter of all parliamentarians, they had something like a third or even you know, more of the overall votes of the country. So it was very much in their interest to change the voting system so it's proportionally representative of people's preferred parties.
So they would list, like, I would want this one first, this one second.
So
like
the idea, at its basic level, I mean, it depends a lot, lots of different means of counting votes, but at the basic level, you have one preference. You count them all up, and then you assign a proportional amount of parliament of representatives. So if you count up, if there's 100 million people in the country and there's 100 seats in parliament, then more or less it's about a million votes per seat. So if as a party you get 10 million votes, you would have 10 seats. This would be proportionally representative.
Okay.
It still wouldn't be potentially very good because it might be that you have parties where they're everybody's second choice, but nobody's first choice.
Right, yeah.
And then it's like, if you don't collect the second choices, you can't adequately utilize that information.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you end up with systems like, I don't know, approval voting and board accounts and all sorts of stuff to try to better introduce this information into the final aggregation. Better introduce the idea that, well, you know, it might be that people don't have a single party that they are 100% behind, and with all of the parties being 0% behind.
Right.
Maybe there's a combination that they're quite happy with.
Sure.
The idea was to take what the UK had currently been using, which is a first-past-the-post system. Mm-hmm. So basically the UK is split up into constituencies, so regions, of around 50,000 people each.
Mm-hmm.
And then each region votes independently, such that there is, they just count which person gets the most votes.
In that region, like an MP or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then that person gets sent to Parliament, and they represent that region.
Okay.
So you can easily have it in a heavily split region where someone gets there with 30% of the turnout voters and even less of the actual residents.
Yeah, right, okay.
There are some like places in like Northern Ireland where turnout is super low. It's like, you know, 15,000, 10,000 people out of like 50,000.
And they get a whole seat in the parliament.
And then, yeah, of those, maybe 40% of the voters.
Yeah.
Actually command who goes to the ones that voted for the person that goes to parliament. So it's like it's not proportional in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And how much influence you have depends a lot on where in which constituency you live in.
Sure.
What the turnout is, what everybody else in that constituency, what parties they like. If you happen to live in a constituency where more than 50% of your fellow constituents will always vote for one particular party, absolutely set on one particular party, your vote literally doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter who you vote for, because 50%, like, this guy is going to Parliament regardless of what the other 49% vote.
Mm-hmm. So we see that a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And there's, I don't know, 10 representatives, and it'll be all 10, and they'll go with a 51% party. And it's like, what? It should be 5-5, surely.
Right, okay.
But yeah, so the idea was, well, let's have a system where we don't break the all system. So this is one of the key propositions of the thing that I was bringing forward.
Hmm.
People get weirded out by proportional representation, in part because it's they start voting for party rather than person.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, is I don't know, maybe it's questionable, maybe it's not, but like there is an argument that in a voting system where we are voting, we are delegating our democratic authority to a third party, that we should know which third party we are delegating that authority to, like which person is actually going to be representing us. This is one of the sort of an argument for this democratic model. I should delegate to a person, not to a group.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's strong. So it should support both. So the proposition was it should support both delegating to person and delegating to party. And secondly, that it should retain, in the case of delegating to person, the constituency model.
Hmm.
So you still vote within your constituency.
Hmm.
The key difference with the model is to the current first-past-the-post system. So it retains a constituency model. Members of parliament represent a constituency. It retains the ability for you to vote within your constituency for your a person who may or may not be affiliated with a party. The key difference is that there's an extra box next to on the voting sheet, which is, I don't mind being temporarily moved to another constituency if it helps get the party of the person I'm voting in. So it's like, because in the UK, and this is based around the idea that within the country, there is freedom of movement, right? So it doesn't matter. I am free to move from Lancaster to York if I want to do so.
Sure.
There is nothing wrong with that.
Right.
It's sort of similar in the EU, right? I'm free to move from Belgium to Germany if I desire as an EU citizen.
Hmm.
not one at the moment, but I will be hopefully soon. This is a basic part of living in a free country, that you are free to move in the country.
Yeah, right.
So then the idea is, well, then in that case, it doesn't make sense to limit my vote geographically. If I'm free to move, why would my vote be limited to only being used in this constituency? Now, maybe I don't want my vote to be used to vote for someone other than this very particular person. Maybe. But I suspect in a lot of cases, people don't vote for the person, they vote for the party, in which case they would check the box. I don't care if my vote is used for this person or someone else from the same party.
Okay.
Now, what happens is we have this algorithm. And what it does is it basically says, right, the algorithm is free to move people temporarily, purely for the purposes of voting, from one constituency to another constituency and vote instead in their election.
Hmm.
Right? Their vote gets removed from the constituency that they were notionally and originally, and instead their vote is used in this new constituency.
Hmm.
And what the algorithm's able to do is basically take constituencies that are the most unanimous and say, right, all of the people who didn't vote for the winner, why would they, and have checked the extra box saying they don't mind if their vote's moved, why would they bother staying there?
That's interesting.
So what we do is we move them elsewhere, but in order to move them elsewhere, we require the winning party to fill them up with a member of a voter from themselves. So what they do is they move one of their voters from a losing constituency, one where they're never going to win. They've only got like 200 people,
sure,
200
okay.
voters, right?
Okay.
And they move those voters out, drain that constituency, which they're never going to win anyway, and instead replace them with the voters that no longer want to vote in their winning constituency,
sure, okay,
right?
Yeah.
Because they're never going to win either.
Right.
And so they basically swap. It identifies constituencies where basically we move people, we swap them over in order to have, broadly speaking, constituencies that are unanimous.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, you can't make it perfectly unanimous. Some people don't want to leave. And there will be instances where you can't find you can't pair two constituencies because they don't have people that would want to swap.
Yeah, okay.
But in general, you'll be able to find constituencies that do have people that want to swap, with the idea being that as much as you can, the algorithm delivers constituencies that are unanimous. And then, because the constituencies are unanimous, we end up with a more or less proportional representation.
And I can also imagine this somewhat empowering the voters as well, to feel like even if they're in a place where maybe their neighbors wouldn't agree with them politically, they still do have a voice as well.
Yeah. Their voice moves to another part of the country.
Fascinating. Were there any other interesting jobs you found yourself doing in the time before you stumbled into the Ethereum mission?
So after university, I went to work in the video games industry. So I
In what capacity?
Well, I wanted to help make video games. What I ended up doing was help making the audio engine part of video games. So basically like a high-performance audio system, something that could play sound effects, music,
cool.
Do certain like tricks like filters and 3D sounds and this kind of thing. The main thing that made it fun was it was a bit of a challenge. At the time, it was late 2005 that I was beginning. For those who can't remember, there was two new consoles on the about to be released, PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360.
Mm-hmm.
PlayStation 3 had some crazy hardware, crazy at the time anyway.
Yeah.
It had this cell processor, which was basically a three-core processor that had like three regular cores, but then it had like six or seven symbiotic cores, which could do like crazy fast math operations, but weren't very good at general purpose stuff.
Hmm.
And so I set about trying to make an audio engine that worked well for the PlayStation 3 with its very exotic hardware, the Xbox 360 with its less exotic hardware, and then the PC with its very much not exotic hardware at
all.
So something that was the same code but would work in all three environments. And this was an interesting challenge.
No doubt.
I got a research paper from it, which I was pretty proud of it. It was like really nice little research paper. It got accepted to an international conference. Unfortunately, I wasn't allowed to publish it by the owners of the company, and this cemented my desire then to leave the company. It was an abstract paper. It wasn't going to give away any secrets. And then in the end, they didn't use the code that I wrote. So it was like, this was definitely an intellectual endeavor, but not much more. Then I moved into basically freelancing. So I did basically, 3 months of work every 1.5 years or so. And then the rest of the time just did my own projects, like the voting system. I did a few other random jobs, like teach English and teach maths and art at like a middle school. And for the maths and art, I taught mostly like fractals. I was very keen on making a big kind of space simmy game, kind of like in the old... what they call like Star Citizen, Privateer, EVE Online, Elite was the original one back in the 80s. I actually went to work for the guy that made Elite. This was like my first and only job out of 9-to-5 kind of job
Of
university. Kind of wanted to go help him make the new version of Elite, and then actually they weren't doing that. But it was something that I wanted to do. And in order to make the game, I decided I needed a new language. This is a hole that many a programmer has fallen in. It's like, I'm going to do this project. But first, to do that project, I'm going to make a new language. And it's inevitably you get like a third of the way through writing the new language. And then you lose interest in the project. You lose interest in the language. And it's
how many new languages have they created in your life, Gav?
A few.
Okay.
I wrote this new language, but it was actually a really interesting one. It was a language workbench, which is still a relatively novel concept. There are very many examples of them. But basically, it's a programming environment where you don't program. In normal programming environments, you program in text, right? So you literally type out reams of text. I mean, it's symbolic. It's like, but it's all like typewriter text. Parentheses, like alphanumeric numbers, letters, dot, comma, semicolon. Like it's all very like you've got the, when you're writing an email, like you have the formatting turned off and it's just typewriter text. No smileys, nothing. And my idea was, well, let's not limit ourselves to just typewriter text. Let's instead allow for really rich display and input. So basically, like if you use Microsoft Word, you don't type in typewriter text. When you type, it's like kind of how it will appear when you print it out, right? This was a novelty when it was called WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get, right? Okay. It was a novelty in the early 90s. If you wind back to like the mid 80s, people didn't type like this. They typed in what we would now. What now looks a little bit like Markdown or HTML. They actually typed in kind of lines of just typewriter text without any kind of formatting. The formatting was introduced as kind of like set commands that you could read in the text, a bit like HTML. Why are we always programming in HTML when we can imagine writing code in a proper HTML, like in a proper Microsoft Word style editor, where the code is displayed in terms that we want it to be displayed in, like display a math formula actually in maths, like where the numerator is above the denominator,
right?
Rather than having it on the numerator on the left and then a slash sign and then the denominator on the right.
Like,
why should we be forced into seeing it as a typewriter typed out? When we publish documents, we write the math in the way that it was meant to be written, in the most comprehensible way. We can't do that with code. We're forced into this very typewriter straitjacket, as though code has to be able to be typed on a typewriter.
Right, and you have all this mental overhead where you're trying to translate it, right?
Exactly. And eventually, part of becoming a coder is kind of warping your mind so that, in the like in the Matrix, I don't see the text anymore. I just see blonde redhead, right? it's kind of the same thing. It's like, I don't really... As a seasoned coder, you don't really notice that you're only writing in a way that you could write on a typewriter. But as we get more and more expressive languages, it becomes increasingly important to be able to format this, to split apart, kind of the formatting into something that you're very happy with, not like a one-size-fits-all, lowest common denominator typewriter style. Mm. So basically, this was the project. It was like the ability to create a what we call a domain-specific language, but not just a domain. So a domain-specific language is, this is the thing I'm, this is the kind of thing I want to write. This is the domain, kind of thing I want to write. I will make a language that makes it easier to write that kind of thing.
Hmm.
So if it's, if my domain is, let's say, something that is very matrix heavy, so these grids of numbers and you can multiply them with each other, and I don't know, it's very useful in certain things, like certain branches of maths, then that should be it should be possible to write things in kind of math, in native kind of matrix math. There should be a way of developing a developing the base language to have this new kind of expressibility that really helps me say what I want to say.
To extend the metaphor a bit, maybe it's like programming slang or a programming accent.
Yeah, programming dialect. Yeah,
dialect. Exactly. Yeah, nice.
Yeah. This is kind of what I was working on for, I don't know, a year or so.
Gotcha.
Maybe two. Oof, it was a long time.
What were you doing just before you got rolled into the Ethereum project?
I was working on legal stuff.
Right.
So I had a startup with a friend, and we were trying to make a extension for Microsoft Word, basically, that would understand to some degree legal documents like contracts, and that it would help you write contracts, and it would also help you understand contracts. So it would like highlight bits that maybe were inconsistent, or where there was a potential error, or where a term wasn't properly defined, this kind of thing. But it would also help you, as you're writing out the document, help you, maybe you've used a new term, you'd be able to like click a shortcut and it would just insert the term at the top in the dictionary. It turns out legal contracts, I didn't know this at the time, before I started, but I learned on the job, they're pretty heavily structured documents. They're not a million miles apart from a programming language.
Ah.
Like they're pretty formal documents. They have a grammar, they have a structure.
Hmm.
And they don't, although there's many dialects, they don't deviate too far from a base level structure. And it wasn't too difficult to basically determine what the structure was within the plugin and sort of abide by it and help the user create and understand the document within that structure.
Hmm.
I think these days it would be pretty much entirely removed with generative AI. I think you would just basically feed the contract in and tell, say, right,
sure, yeah,
add this extra course. Although that said, it may be a little bit. So the issue I have with generative AI seems to be that it's like a bullshitter, right? It's like someone who's ultra confident and superficially seems to know what they're talking about, but when you dig into it more than a superficial amount, you realize it's total nonsense. And this seems to me, I mean, maybe it's going to be improved over time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would expect it to be improved over time. But at the moment, it's a little bit dangerous in that regard, because if people who can't recognize bullshit start using it, then we're just going to have what we assume to be de-sibbled attack vectors of society kind of re-sibbled, because crappy AI will be speaking through vast amounts of clever people and making them look a lot cleverer than they are, but still not clever enough that what they're saying makes sense.
What? Because there's like this mass behind them because everybody's saying the same thing?
At the moment, we assume that when someone says or writes something, if they're saying or writing a lot, and if it looks like it might make sense, there is a sort of a threshold that they have crossed and they should be listened to. They are at a minimum intellect level to be able to write something that is grammatically correct and doesn't use all caps and hashtag and forth. Plus they have dedicated enough of their personal time to writing it. So there's a natural de-sibling, right, of information coming to us if it appears to be coming from a person.
Hmm.
And so we can give it the time of day. We can have a look at it and see if it's reasonable.
Hmm.
And The issue is that as AI becomes more prevalent, this natural desibling falls by the wayside. It's no longer resilient. It's no longer reliable. Anyone can basically take the output of an AI and suggest that it's what they have written and think.
Yeah.
And now we have the problem that we cannot rely merely on an utterance coming from a person that seems to have that seems to be well formed, having any amount of intellectual robustness. Like we actually have to dedicate the effort to reading it through and trying to work out its underlying meaning.
Yeah, right.
And this is the problem. We're going to be deluged with novel bullshit. And this, I think, is the big problem that, that the world is facing generative AI. It's like novel bullshit. It's novel because we haven't seen it before and it appears to be legit. And yet it's bullshit because if you scratch the surface, you realize that it doesn't make any sense. I don't disagree that AI poses some new problems, though I kind of dislike the vibe that all of the established powers of the world are against AI, because it feels like they're mostly against AI in some sense challenging the authority of the established narrative.
Yeah, no doubt. Absolutely. Hey, there's a whole conversation there. What will the systems of governance look like when some of the actors are artificial? So you don't see AI as an existential threat? Like when computers start being able to articulate matter, for instance, and they're making decisions of how to do so, you don't see that as an existential threat?
I think there's a lot of existential threats to our existence, but I think the biggest one, I don't see AI as being the one that's on the horizon right now.
Gotcha.
I think the one that's on the horizon right now is people with no great or no foundational stake in society getting to the point where they can destabilize our current physical environment. So I'm thinking in particular, nuclear weapons and the increasing, the lack of resilience our society seems to have, our civilization seems to have for managing the fact that, you know, we are a couple of button clicks away from annihilation.
Yes, that's right.
And it's like, yeah, you know, we've kind of managed for the last 50 years or so. Not having those buttons be clicked.
Right. But that probability is...
over time, they will get clicked, right? Over a sufficiently long period of time.
That's right.
The noise function, which is human action, means that they will get clicked. And so we have to really come up with a better and more resilient system for managing this. And it seems that at the moment we're going in the wrong direction. We're going the opposite direction. We're increasing the noise function next to those very, very like exterminate humanity buttons.
Right.
And that's really not so good. So I would say this is the bigger existential threat at the moment. So I definitely think clever machines will be a destabilizing effect on society, like most groundbreaking technology is. Will they be able to be regulated and managed by the current powers that be? Probably more so than decentralized technology, yes, simply because AI is a necessarily centralized technology at the moment. It requires huge amounts of compute power to develop these models, and it's pretty easy to work out where that compute power is and knock on their door if they're doing something wrong.
Sure, yeah, that's right. Speaking of AI generating bullshit, you know, there's probably a spectrum. There's going to be a bunch of different AIs, and they're all going to be producing different amounts of bullshit, you could say. I think a lot of it has to do with the how much bullshit are fed into the models to train them, right? This is a risk. Your work is all about establishing this ledger of verifiable truths, things that have actually happened.
Yeah.
You started on Ethereum. Were you thinking about governance at all when you started to code up Ethereum?
Yeah, quite a bit. It was a conversation Vitalik and I had a few times.
Okay.
With the idea being that Ethereum would become a DAO,
This was the
Ethereum was supposed to be a DAO.
The Ethereum was eventually going to become a DAO. Like this was the Ethereum Foundation was only meant to exist for as long as we didn't have the DAO. The DAO would be the thing that we delivered once we delivered Ethereum.
Okay, it's 2023. How many years ago was that discussion?
10 years ago. Almost.
Okay. Okay.
They're coming up to the 10-year anniversary.
Okay.
So this is something that I was very keen on with Polkadot, mm-hmm. like delivering this original Ethereum vision of the DAO, DAO-based blockchain. And I think to some degree that's happened. But post-launch of Ethereum, it was something that I was very keen on following through with, mostly because I saw a lot of... I saw an annoying combination, like a difficult combination of chaos and authority forming in terms of determining Ethereum's direction. So we had these like weekly calls where we discussed the protocol, and the calls were open, anyone could say anything, and at the end of the call we had this kind of vote. And it's like if it was unanimous, then we kind of assume that then it will. It was a bit odd because it was like, okay, so anyone who turns up can in principle vote something down, and we're not limiting who can turn up.
Okay.
So it's a bit of an odd governance model. Like, it doesn't seem resilient in any way.
Yeah,
it's eventually just gonna
a little underdeveloped. Yeah. Okay.
Now in reality, it was something more akin to a papal model where there is a pope and the pope listens to the advisors, to the cardinals and random people they might happen to wander past in the congregation. But at the end of the day, the pope makes the decision. And the pope is benevolent and they will listen to good points.
Of course.
And maybe things will change if the pope feels that there is a need for it to change. But there is an unwritten... I mean, in principle, the Pope is first among equals, right? In principle, the Pope has no greater power than anyone else.
Uh-huh.
But the reality is that decisions are made by convention by the Pope. I felt that was the model that Ethereum had silently slipped into.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't feel as a model that was especially resilient, or for that matter, in keeping with the nature of what we were building. And so I set out to make a more resilient governance model.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I published something called the Yellow Paper Council, which is a little bit similar to the fellowship, a Polkadot fellowship, which is basically, look, Ethereum can be defined unambiguously by the Yellow Paper. The Yellow Paper exists as a LaTeX file. We can propose changes to that LaTeX file and people can vote on it. The ability to vote on it can be the ability to have a vote can be, you know, we can work out some condition that can be evaluated by whoever, the Ethereum community, the wider community, to sort of elevate people into the Yellow Paper Council.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of wrote it out as a basic governance mechanism. Now, it was not going to be on-chain particularly. I think eventually the idea was that it would become on-chain.
Sure.
And I think, yeah, that's right. I actually wrote it up as a smart contract on Ethereum that Parity Ethereum used to determine whether it should update itself. So it's like there was a concept of the Yellow Paper Council, there was a concept of voting for an upgrade, and then the Parity Ethereum would sort of look out for new upgrades and then download the new thing and automatically restart itself with a new upgraded version of itself when it was meant to. So it was sort of an early version of forkless upgrades.
Cool. How was this received by the wider Ethereum community, especially those who generally held authority over decisions?
I think there were elements that welcomed the tractability of decision making. I think, as with any political system, those individuals that stand to lose influence or that stand to have their power reduced,
mm-hmm.
will necessarily be against any alteration to the power structures, to the polity.
Mm.
It's just a natural part of humanity. Right? Tolkien covered this in Lord of the Rings. It's like, you know, I might want to use the ring to do good, but in reality, once I have that power, my main concern will be not losing that power.
That's right.
I think we see this everywhere, and it's just a not very human thing, or a superhuman thing, to be able to give up power, to be able to see power for the ball and chain that it is.
Wow.
And I think people do, but I think oftentimes they're not the people that end up in power.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Right. Maybe you can't have that gene if you do end up in power or something like that.
A system of governance that not only provides power to those who merit the power, to those who will make good decisions, but also to those who will not utilize the power to retain power.
Yeah, right.
Is crucial, and probably a system is only resilient in the long term if it guarantees the second thing even more potently than it guarantees the first thing, which is to say, one should prefer those who will not attempt to retain power at all costs over those who are likely to make the best decisions. Oftentimes, these two will be competing. Like, an individual will deliver the first, but also may risk the second.
Mm-hmm.
And a system that ensures that they never attempt to retain power is probably more important to ensure that second point, that anyone in control doesn't attempt to retain control more than the first point.
At a certain point in Ethereum, it became too constrained. It seemed like we weren't going to be upgrading, we weren't going to be evolving. We just had Phil on the show last week. He told the saga of EIP 999, this whole thing. Yeah. You started to develop Polkadot, we're going to skip ahead a little bit, and you wound up with what you called Governance One, which was this council model. People were able to elect a council, not one person, one vote, but based on the amount of DOT they held or KSM they held. How do you think Governance One went? And was it designed to be the ultimate solution, or was it always meant to be a step?
No, it was a stopgap solution. Mm-hmm. And I think I seem to remember speaking in China when I introduced Governance One, pointing this out very clearly. This is the first iteration. It will get us past launch. It will not be the final solution.
Uh-huh.
The idea was that in the early days, we may need to take emergency actions. We may need to fix bugs. We may need to revert or restart. Or as such, we need a more coherent model for decision making.
Yeah.
And that's where the council came from. There was also the technical committee. So it was actually a sort of tricameral structure. So we had the technical committee, which was originally meant to be lots of different implementer teams and research teams. In reality, it sort of ended up being just the Web3 Foundation and Parity. Then there was the council, which was a voted something used a fragment voting algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
In some sense, it was an approval vote system, so you could approve of several people,
right?
And it would use your vote to ensure that as many of those people got a seat on the council as possible. I think the council was originally 13 members.
Sounds
11.
Right.
11 or 13. Mm-hmm. I think the Kusama Council went up to 19 or so.
Yeah.
And the council could make a proposal that could be fast-tracked. I think the council had its own ability to put forward a proposal.
Yeah, they were called motions, right?
Motions,
yeah.
And then separately, there was the main sort of referendum room, mm-hmm. which would be needed to get a vote through, and then votes. Ah, yes, that's right. The council could alter what the counting mechanism was.
That's right.
These three different things, right?
Yeah, we had one once that the council put to voters at a 50-50.
Yeah.
Because it was like controversial. So they're like, okay, well, everybody go figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like majority carries or positive turnout bias or negative turnout bias, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, as I said, I think it delivered some of what we needed. Well, The thing it would definitely didn't deliver was a decentralization.
Yeah.
It was not long-term going to be resilient. Mm-hmm. And we're already seeing, you know, regulation continuing to up its game, continuing to sort of identify systems that have relatively few actors in, much like the council, and try to break them apart into their individuals and then...
Who has authority and go after them, right?
Go after them.
Yeah.
And this is problematic mm-hmm. for a decentralized system. I think the only real way of being sort of... the only proven decentralized model is Bitcoin's, right? Hmm. Or at least the only proven sort of properly economic decentralized model is Bitcoin's, which is basically where individuals are not readily identifiable because it's like, I don't know, IP addresses or cryptographic keys. And secondly, so actually not IP addresses, where there are nodes on a network. Now, you might run enough of the network to maybe be able to identify a node for where a block came from, but one can hide one's IP address on the Bitcoin network fairly effectively. And as I say, cryptographic keys, which are pseudonymous perhaps, but still not readily, don't allow you to readily identify an individual. And this is how Bitcoin... rewards its validators, and indeed how, you know, validators in Bitcoin kind of identify themselves. And I think it's a model that works. It's a model that has not been shut down, has stood this relatively strong test of time, 15 years. Mm-hmm. We don't have, in some sense, therefore, OpenGov, the next generation governance, was what this was based on. Governance one, was much more based on saying, well, we're in the early stage of launching a network. Mm-hmm. Let's ensure that we can fix it if it breaks. And so these were the two sort of divergent things that were drawing us in different directions.
Relatively smooth transition to OpenGov. Mm-hmm. We tried it out on Kusama for, I think, 7 months. Drained a fair bit of the treasury, but otherwise... pretty good. Now it's running quite happily on Polkadot. Is there anything you would change about the initial parameters at this point?
Yeah, I definitely think some of the parameters need to be tweaked. I think there's already an RFC that I've put my thoughts regarding.
What are the main points on that?
Certainly reducing some of the decision times on Kusama, changing a few of the curves, mm-hmm. Changing some of the deposits.
To be more accessible or harder?
More accessible for most of them.
Okay, yeah.
Harder for... some more accessible, some harder.
Okay, all right.
I think the bigger spends, the idea is to make it longer. Mm-hmm. The smaller spends, easier. Mm-hmm. I think for Kusama, really shortening that decision period is a good plan.
Cool.
Try and get things much more sort of reactive and adaptive. I think the biggest alteration needed... and this is something that is being worked on, is just moving away from the central treasury model. So the central treasury needs to exist. Where do you put the funds? Mm-hmm. But it should be moved out in larger chunks to a more delegative model for individuals that are happy to be delegated to, and obviously the community is happy to be delegated towards, in a manner a little bit reminiscent of Gov1. Which is where the council controlled the treasury. Mm-hmm. So I can well imagine that we might have quite a few such councils controlling a number of different treasuries, a little bit similar to the fellowship. One can imagine a fellowship treasury, or one can also imagine like a marketing fellowship, which has its own treasury.
Sure.
Having multiple treasuries to handle these various different areas of funding. Mm-hmm. Is really what we need to strive towards now. So we have, so that we're not constantly asking the wider ecosystem to fund, you know, 3K here and 8K there and 50K. And then as soon as someone says, well, you know, I want 5 million, it's like, well, that will never go through, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is, they will then argue, well, we want a degree of certainty that we will get funded over the next 3 years. And it's like, okay, so something has to give here. And I think the thing that has to give is, well, if you have a longer-lived fellowship membership, like, a wallet fellowship that funds wallets, Nova, Subwallet,
Talisman,
we can imagine there would be a greater level of faith that a team that sort of is building a 18-month, 2-3-year project would have a greater deal of faith that they will get funding for the project's duration.
Yeah.
When it is a constrained group of people that are making that decision rather than any old token holder that sort of might want to come in and have their vote be heard with arbitrary amount of conviction.
Or just their voice, even if sometimes they don't even have a vote, right?
Yeah.
It's a little bit hardcore right now, for sure. Mm. We see people ground down to maybe the worst of themselves sometimes. Mm. It can be a bit intense. But also good for burning off the things that are useless, the people that are just here to take money.
Yeah, I definitely... I think there's a... I mean, it's probably like, you know, 20%, 60%, 20%, right? So there's like a 20% hardcore that are never going.
Yeah.
There's a 20% that are just opportunistic, that are just here as long as the good times roll.
Yeah,
and then
there's
kind of 60% in the middle that you kind of, you don't, yeah, it's a bit of both. You know, they're kind of into it, but they kind of also do need, they do want to make a bit of money. They want to, you know, they want to be comfortable.
Yeah,
and it's like... It's how deep into the first 20%, you cut loose and that's fine. And then it's like how deep into the next 60% that mm-hmm. you're going to cut. And I think, you know, it's not going to be maybe a big issue if you cut into some of this, but you definitely, you know, you want to retain, it's that 60% that some of the sort of crazy ideas that no one really thinks could be that good end up coming from and being developed by.
Yeah.
Like the 20% that are going to be there forever, like they're a relatively small group of people. And they are, you know, they're dedicated to the underlying mission, but they're not necessarily, they don't number very many, and they're not necessarily going to be thinking too hard outside of this relatively focused sort of mission.
Sure.
Nonetheless, I do believe that there's an element in this entire industry that is here really not believing in the underlying goal of, like, you know, self-sovereignty, decentralization, and so forth, but really just here to make a bit of crypto.
Yeah, you can sense it off them. Transitioning to a model where the treasury split up and maybe we have more of a council taking care of these different treasuries. Do you worry at all that again opens us up to the attack vector from governments and nations that want to pick Polkadot apart?
It's a trade-off. Hmm. There is no perfect design.
That's right.
So it's necessarily has an element of this. Now, the question is, to what degree are you resilient, right? If your entire governance system works around, you know, whatever, 13 people not being intimidated or, you know, coerced in some way, it's not very resilient. Like, your entire governance system is probably broken. But if you have, let's say... 5 different fellowships, each, or maybe 10, each with, I don't know, between 25 and 100 people in, and controlling each, I don't know, one tenth of the annual budget, then it's like, okay, maybe they, you know, go after 20 people in one of the smaller fellowships and they take a 12th of the annual budget. But you haven't lost that much, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or they freeze it or something. Uh-huh. And then it's like, okay, now we understand. Now we know where the threshold is. And we have to be a little bit more careful, right?
Sure,
we have to
sure.
be more decentralized. We have to be... And but the point is that we say it's like graceful degradation, right?
Hmm.
As the system's resilience gets called into question, as the system's functionality gets degraded, it happens gracefully. It happens a little bit at a time, which means we can adapt.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if your entire system is foundationally based on 13 people, and if they get screwed, or if, even worse, if a majority of them get sort of intimidated or coerced or whatever, then the entire system goes down and you can't fix it. It doesn't gracefully degrade. It ungracefully degrades. It's catastrophic.
Mm.
So the main thing I think is that we're at the end of the day, it's sort of cutting edge stuff. We can't afford not to sail quite close to the wind, so we have to sail close to the wind. But we do so in a way that if the ship topples, it doesn't sink everybody.
Yeah, right. I wanted to ask you about this concept of democracy, because I've heard leaders in the ecosystem say, ah, yes, open gov is a great democracy. And I've also believe I've heard you say open gov was never intended to be a democracy. Now, I think the term is a little bit ambiguous, one of these terms we take for granted. Can you help define what you see as democracy and speak to the role it plays in open gov?
Yeah, so this is a conversation I had many, many years ago with Aaron about what a democracy is.
Yeah.
There's a good quote from Peep Show. It's a great comedy on in the UK. I can heartily recommend everybody watch it. I think the quote is, can't I just have everything I want all of the time? Isn't that what a democracy is? I mean, you know, you can, if you want to like a... Like the idealized democracy, there's the Athenian democracy, right? So this is the original, this is where the word comes from, rule by the people. And in this case, it was a particular city, and it was in ancient Greece. And it's, you know, the people that could vote were like, not the slaves, not the women.
Right.
The guys of a certain age. Like,
ruled by these people.
Yeah. But it was a broad enough group. It was like, you know, in the tens of thousands that it in the thousands anyway, that it made sense to give it a name different to all of the other things that are basically dictatorships, monarchies, imperial aristocracies, and so forth. It's used, saying X is a democracy is pretty meaningless these days, unless we specifically want to refer to an Athenian democracy, like one person, one vote. And even then, it's questionable what if that translates into the modern day, where, you know, we have we do broadly expect to have everybody's vote be counted equally. Everybody to be able to have a vote. Maybe not 3-year-olds, but like maybe 3-year-olds should be given a vote. I don't know. Instead, what we can talk about is democratic. A system being democratic, and it might be more or less democratic. So we can imagine a system that has proportional representation, that has universal suffrage, that has high turnout numbers, maybe even pays for people to turn out. This might be a more democratic system to like a system where it's like there's only two parties and it doesn't matter which party you vote for in almost all of the areas, almost all regions that you live. This might be considered a less democratic system. Still not like not a democracy or something, but like it's not very democratic. So I think, you know, democracy, rule of the people. So it's like, is the rule in the hands of the people? I guess that's like a good rule of thumb to determine whether a system is democratic. It's like, are there interests here that could be said to be to influence an outcome greater than the people? But this is like a whole avenue of political philosophy that, you know, I know too little about to really give a considered opinion on. The only thing I would say is that there isn't a particularly well-received understanding of the word democracy. And the best I could do with democratic is saying a system is more democratic if any given individual has approximately the same level of influence of the system over any other individual.
Sure.
That doesn't really... that's a fairly theoretical, like abstract definition, and it's not so easy to reason. I mean, it's not trivial to reason how democratic any given system is. You'd have to analyze how much influence any given individual has. And the interesting point I'd note here is that it's not about voting systems. Voting systems play a large part, but it's not merely about voting systems. As I mentioned before, one can conceive a democratic system. One can actually conceive of a perfectly democratic system that has no voting system. This would be the dictator for a day with a perfectly random selection over which citizen is the dictator for any given day.
Okay.
Right? And this is perfectly democratic by my definition.
Sure.
Because everybody has the same level of influence over the system as anybody else. Everyone has the same chance of becoming the dictator. And, you know, we could just say, well, one person is dictator for, 10 years. And we choose that person randomly. And technically, until we choose that person, as long as it is a random selection, then it is also a perfect democracy. Because everybody has the same chance of influencing.
Okay, so it's about chances, not about...
Well, I mean, there is no other way of mathematically reasoning other than through probability in this case, because it's a probabilistic outcome. Mm-hmm. It's like, who will be the dictator? Well, who will have influence over any given decision? Well, it's randomly determined. Okay, what are the chances? Well, I have exactly, if I'm, I don't know, in the system with a million other people, I have exactly 1/1,000,000th of a chance, which by the definition of a perfectly democratic system means that I have exactly the same level of influence as everybody else.
Right.
Because it's exactly the same 1/1,000,000th of a chance of being the one who decides something.
Right. Well, you know, this is all very ideological. And in the end, ideology doesn't always translate into progress and efficiency in the real world. In the last couple weeks and months, there's been, I would say, a growing saltiness by maybe holders that feel like they don't have a lot of influence, shaking their fist at the lack of democracy, things like this.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we have a unique system here where those with the most to lose have generally the most say in what we do.
Mm.
Do you pay attention to the landscape of governance? Are you watching closely?
Not closely. I'm watching... Not so closely.
Okay. Well, let me lay it out to our viewers as well. We're talking at the beginning of November 2023. Mm. And on Polkadot, I would say there are four obvious groups, voting groups. We have this 16DG character who swings around 30 million voting power. Recently, they're actually doing a lot of transparent work in niches of the community to organize, to create systems and create competition. That's interesting. We have this Chaos DAO, where it's a reputation system. You get in based on reputation, then it's one person, one vote to dictate a stack.
Yeah.
Ivy is quite powerful. This seems to be sort of one person, one vote, but you have to delegate, and if you delegate more, you actually get the say, but you'll listen to everybody kind of system. And then finally, there's like, I don't know, there's these bags that come out for system upgrades, and otherwise they're pretty quiet. But what do you think about these, like, they're kind of like sub-governance systems forming?
I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And the fact that this has arisen, I would say, is an indication that OpenGov is doing its job in facilitating new systems, new mechanisms.
Yeah.
It's always a good sign it's a good sign of the underlying design of a system if you end up with emergent effects that get utilized, that people find are useful, that you did not originally predict would happen. I've floated around a few votes. I don't generally cast my opinion because I fear that would be a little too... it could prejudice things too much.
No doubt.
But, you know, I have my opinion on a lot of things, and occasionally I might put my bag to
nice.
To use.
Good. Do you mind sharing any that you put your bag to?
Again, I don't want to go into too many, name too many names. I do think I will go into my general thoughts, though. I don't think that it's sensible to pretend that the Treasury is a VC fund. And I noticed that there is a sentiment within the community that is seeking to compare the Treasury as a funding source with VCs, and in particular, on the similar terms to what a VC would fund, except for the part of ownership.
Uh-huh.
I don't think this is a sensible comparison to make.
Hmm.
for a couple of reasons. One of them is due diligence. VCs do a lot of due diligence. And there are people whose reputations are on the line if a VC that are not the recipients of funding, if a VC does badly on a large outlay. Secondly, VCs are protected in by law from funds being misspent. This puts an impetus on fiduciary responsibility on the recipient of funding that just isn't there with Treasury funding. Thirdly, VCs tend to not provide, or although they might sign up for providing a certain chunk of funding, they will typically not provide all of the money up front. And there are legal means by which a VC can seek to exit from a contract. That, again, tends not to be what is proposed with regards to the Treasury. In part because those who are receiving the funding want to ensure that they have they receive the fiat that they're expecting, not necessarily the crypto that they're expecting.
That's right.
I think that the legal situation is for me, one of the most crucial and one of the most underrepresented. And it's why Treasury funding must happen in relatively small chunks for the final outlay, but could in principle be managed in much larger chunks when it's given to a broader, more less highly aligned group of delegates, like a fellowship. So it's not that it's not that I don't see an answer to teams that are seeking this kind of funding, but I don't think they should be seeking it from the Treasury. And so when I see, you know, a large proposal of funding with basically zero safeguards that it will be spent on what we expect it to be spent on, when I see zero safeguards that it won't be that what is built might ultimately be repurposed for something outside of Polkadot, when I see zero safeguards that what is being built might be ultimately combined with some for-profit fund mechanism that would allow them to disproportionately benefit from it.
Yeah.
All of this stuff that would be naturally just impossible to do as a VC under VC funding. I mean, even under company law, leaving apart VC funding for now, as an investor in a company, there are all sorts of avenues that you can go down to prevent a team from basically doing anything but helping make you richer. If you, for example, you've come to a realization that actually this product isn't the thing that the market needs, it's this product.
Yeah, yeah.
So what you want to do is start afresh, and you just wind down the company, make a new company with all the same people.
Yeah, yeah.
And make that product instead. That's actually illegal.
Okay.
If you do that, at least in jurisdictions that I'm familiar with, like the UK, you can get sued by those initial investors.
Sure, yeah.
Because basically what you've done is that investor didn't invest in, you know, the product that you said you're going to make. They didn't even invest in the company's mission. What they invested in was that team.
Yeah.
And they can argue that to a court and say, well, what you've done is you've done me out of my investment because you've spent the money, you've you know, done your thing, and now you've wound this down, but you've kind of taken this IP, this comprehension, this team, this underlying asset that has been built in the company these people and these relationships,
and
therefore been paid for by the investor, and you've moved it elsewhere to this other thing that I don't have any ownership of.
Yeah. Right.
And whereas in fact, what they will argue is what you should do is you should try and create more shares and sell those shares. Right. I'm in some sense, you're now married to me. You're not allowed to go to just divorce me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I put money into this marriage. I expect my pound of flesh out.
Yeah.
And so in some sense, you as an investor, you as a shareholder, receive quite a substantial degree of protection that just doesn't exist. There isn't really an equivalent that exists in the Treasury until we have all-encompassing means by which people can say, I agree to this set of rules in perpetuity. It's like whatever sort of agreement I enter into here, like some transaction, maybe tokens, token exchange or whatever.
Yeah.
I agree to be bound by these broader rules, like the laws of society, at some bigger, broader pain of sufferance if I break them. Hmm. What do we need for this? Well, you can say, right, well, we can just say stake, right? You put in 10 grand of stake and that's it. And then it's like, you lose this 10 grand of stake. If you then, I don't know, launch another token a year after you've just done this token, right?
Yeah.
You know, in the same team or whatever. Like we can imagine these like longer term rules that you can stake to say, I will live by them. But it doesn't really work because A, most of the people can't afford 10K just to put up in stake. And B, it would basically limit the amount that you would expect them to raise to about 20K because they would otherwise just use half of them as a cost for paying off the stake
that they already
intend to break. So actually what you need is civil resistance. That's actually what something that the legal system and society provides us with, right?
Yes.
If you have civil resistance, then you don't need the stake because you just say, right, everyone is given a basic level of social credit, right? Of reputation. We trust that you aren't going to do this bad thing. And it's like, as long as you haven't done this bad thing, one of these bigger, longer-term social rules, then your social credit remains intact. But as soon as you do something that's bad, like, for example, do some other startup, like, you know, use up the funding that you get, declare bankruptcy, and then start this new startup using more funding,
yeah,
then you lose your social credit.
Right.
And if you lose your social credit, you're much less likely to be able to get funding because people know that you've already done this thing before. So you need some degree of that, you know, it's ultra long-term reputation system, social credit system, basically civil resistance.
Now, are you talking about like credit as far as funding goes, funding credit, or are you speaking more of like a social credit like?
Kind of reputation system, but reputation system that's managed on chain.
Yeah.
And more crucially, civil resistance system by which it's the ability for... So suppose you want to launch a new project. It would be useful to be able to not have to give away your MeetSpace identity, but yet still be able to say, I have never let investors down previously.
Hmm.
Basically, when an investor buys into, as VCs typically do, a team, it's crucial that there is some understanding that this investment sits with the team, not the project. This is really what is being sold in many respects to investors.
Mm.
And if a product is determined to be not a great fit, but some other product like it is, and the same team wants to build it, then there needs to be some understanding and some enforcement that... That investment should still carry over in some form to this new product, new proposition, even because it's the same team.
So you're hopeful that it's going to be possible to, I mean, not only solve identifying individual humans, but also prevent, let's say, bad actors with a lot of money from just buying, you know, the persona of people in other parts of the world.
I don't think that inevitably people can sell individuality for a fee.
Mm-hmm.
I see this essentially as being a requirement to delivering something that is comparable to what we have in society at the moment. I don't see it as being sufficient.
Mm.
If you're going to raise a lot of cash, then it's not enough just to say, hey, I am an individual. However, if you're going to raise a lot of cash on the basis that they're buying into you, then it's important that this is codified in some way.
Mm.
Because otherwise, an algorithmic investor like the Treasury cannot possibly uphold that. If an algorithmic investor like the Treasury is to work, it must be able to identify individuals and identify the same individual when they come back later for more funding or for funding under a different guise. Now, an algorithmic investor like the Treasury probably also, for large outlays, would want to identify the individual as well, KYC,
right?
Hey, this is why the Treasury should hand me some funding. It's not enough for you to say, I am a person. That's not enough. You need to be able to say, I am a person that can reasonably deliver this. But there needs to be some way of linking. Firstly, there needs to be a way of ensuring that in that first rung, the very first $100 or $10 funding from the Treasury, that that is not something that can be just done time and time again by the same person. So no, I don't think it's enough to have civil resistance, but I do think it's a it opens up a lot of corridors that is that are just not possible if we rely purely on economic incentives or indeed economic disincentives. And one of the things that I think it can help with is things that are in decentralizing systems, in terms of humanly decentralizing systems. Not running them on many computers, but running them under many eyes.
You know, I love this tension between this stark record of truth on the blockchain and this amorphous social layer on the other side. It's all about transparency over here. Over here, we have secrets, right? We have this dark gov versus light gov. Do you think secrets play a role in governance? Or do you think governance works better in the light?
I think we have to understand what our aim is with governance, because there are two competing aims that I've seen. One of them is inclusion, and the other is the degree to which it benefits individuals. So governance, you can look at governance as inputs and outputs, right? Inputs might be what people say, how people act, what people vote, do, how their opinions get counted. And the outputs are what the collective does on this basis, like what the collective does, what money is spent by the Treasury, what upgrades go through, what fellowships form, who is ranked who is not ranked, what events happen, and so forth. Right? I've seen voices out there that say it's. The point of governance is not about delivering good decisions. The point of governance is about ensuring legitimacy. Right?
Of
whatever decisions come out.
Interesting.
And if it's better to have a bad decision come out with clear legitimacy than a good decision without clear legitimacy.
Okay. What do you think about that?
I think it's bullshit.
Okay.
But I accept that it is a viewpoint.
Okay.
I do believe legitimacy is a virtue of a governance system. Not per se, not because it's not purely in and of itself, but rather because it retains the faith of the people within the collective. And a collective is nothing if it has no members. So then we have to look, why do members stay in a collective? Well, they stay in it for two reasons. One, economic benefit. Right? But economic benefit is a very short term. It can be a very fickle thing. And if people don't see economic benefit for a period of time, not everyone is very long-term focused. They may move to an alternate collective. They may get disenfranchised. I'm done. I'm going elsewhere.
Yeah.
I could find the grass is greener over there.
Yes.
Yeah. Just new, right? So I think it's questionable to rely purely on economic incentive. Unless one is confident one can consistently deliver it on the timescale that its desired members expect. The second thing that people look towards within the collective is, I identify with this collective. Well, how would someone identify with a collective? Well, they feel that they are being fairly represented. They feel that decisions made by the collective are legitimate. They look for, perhaps one might argue, I mean, I don't necessarily want to argue this, but they might look for the legitimacy within the collective. Or rather, a collective that appears illegitimate probably would, they would not identify with.
People want to operate under fair rules, even if it doesn't benefit them.
At least. I'd say this is a... I'd say that as long as it benefits them, and as long as you have a rational actor, they don't care about legitimacy. But in the case that it doesn't benefit them, then maybe if it also doesn't appear legitimate, then maybe they're not so... They're not going to stick around.
Yeah.
I would say that legitimacy... is a consideration, but I wouldn't say it's the primary consideration. I would say, I would still say that the primary consideration is making good decisions. And if a system can make good, if a governance system can make good decisions, then it need not necessarily be, it need not necessarily be the paragon of legitimacy. I guess this is a very particular way that I'm using legitimacy here, because legitimacy is different, is essentially fulfilling the expectations of the members according to how it operates and how it makes decisions. And obviously different members can have different expectations, and some will feel that the thing is operating illegitimately even though it's actually perfectly following its rules. It's a difficult concept to really nail down.
We had a very interesting situation happen on Kusama these past few weeks, where very opaque voting bloc, some refer to them as the chaotic entity, they hold something like 320, 350,000 worth of voting power. They appear to just vote whatever opposite the rest vote. So they're kind of like this jester or something like that, you could say.
Contrarian.
Recently, they... very nearly funded an ecosystem agent whose intention was to take those funds and put down the decision deposit to wipe the treasury to zero. So what do you think of, what do you think about that? What do you think about the state of chaos on Kusama and governance? Does it still occupy your mind? Or
Kusama was launched to help test the things that Polkadot would use that could not be tested on a testnet due to the lack of economic incentivization. And I think in that respect, it has done its job very well, and it continues to be an interesting weather vane for what may be arising on Polkadot. I think the fact that there are people within the Kusama community that are concerned about price, a token value and so forth, and indeed the treasury spending and this is a good I don't necessarily agree with them, but I think it's good that Kusama brings it out, because it's helpful to understand the social circumstances, the socioeconomic circumstances in which Polkadot operates. It's another point on the map. And it's important to have as many data points as possible. Honestly, in my opinion, the treasury is there for spending. Markets are funny things, and they operate in funny ways. And there may be, you know, I've read some of the arguments about why maybe you don't want to see the treasury funds handed out to teams that would primarily have fiat expenses. Yeah, you know, it's, I get it. But in my mind, Kusama maybe hasn't done its job quite so effectively, or the Kusama treasury maybe hasn't done its job quite so effectively as I would have wanted, in that it has retained the funds and not spent. Like, the idea was, with the treasury funds, at least when I sort of wrote the code, was that it would be, you know, they'd be spent more or less as they came in. Maybe there'd be a float, but not a huge, it wouldn't run a huge surplus. And if it did run a surplus, the surplus would be primarily there to be utilized as a sort of sovereign wealth fund, maybe buying other tokens, putting it into decentralized exchanges, loans to teams, I don't know. But like, as it stands, it's just like we've moved in some...
sort of almost sleptwalked into fiscal conservatism.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, no, if the funds are in the Treasury, that means they should never be spent. Right. And it's like, well, that really wasn't the intention. Hmm. I don't think it's a terrible thing to have a big treasury. It's like, wow, we've got such a big treasury. We can fund so many cool stuff.
Sure.
But the intention, like, it should be well understood that it's the treasury. It's there for paying for stuff. And it's like, the less it's, the more it's not deployed, the more harm it does. It's like, the worst kind of deployment is burning it, I would argue, because it's like, it will probably have very little effect on Kusama. It will have no immediate effect. I find it hard to imagine it would have a very immediate effect on benefiting individuals within Kusama. I would say it's really just the knee-jerk reaction. But I would still argue, okay, at least it's deploying it, right? At least we're doing something with it, even if it is burning. Now, why do I think burning is maybe better than just leaving it in the treasury ad infinitum? Well, because it reduces the... it makes it clear, I suppose it makes a clear economic argument that funds in the treasury do not contribute to... the supply side, and therefore anyone who is attempting to analyze the market can perhaps argue that it is less inflationary than they would otherwise presuppose. Right?
Okay. We're trying to do something greater than that, though, aren't we?
Exactly. Exactly. And so it's like, I think it's... If it's an argument over the funds stay in the treasury forever, or the funds get burnt, and we just say, yeah, actually, there's not as much inflation, practically speaking, or even theoretically speaking, then okay, if that's the choice, if it's one or the other, then all right, yeah, I'll take the second option, I suppose. But that isn't the choice, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We can deploy it in other ways. And it's like, we should be deploying it in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I read into this is that we need better ways of deploying funds, like better mechanisms by which funds can be deployed, I should say. Better governance in some sense, which, and again, back to the sort of splitting things out, having multiple fellowships, having, you know, people that have, you know, collectives that have remits to be able to fund under a certain class of things that might need funding. One can imagine even a sort of sovereign wealth fellowship, right? That gets given a bunch of the treasury to just go on decentralized exchanges and buy, you know, score other tokens.
Sure,
and retain, you know, or score other assets and retain, make a Kusama sovereign wealth fund.
Hey, speaking of that, there was talk early on about, and it might have even been justification for giving Kusama value, but it was this idea of taking DOT tokens and bringing it into Kusama. Is that, do you think that's still on the cards, or do you think it's certainly on the cards?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where does that DOT come from? The Polkadot Treasury?
Once the bridge gets built? I think it comes, I mean, we'll have to figure that out, but the original idea was that it came from the Web3 Foundation.
Okay.
So we have to like look into, you know,
we've got to ask
the Web3 Foundation kind of, how do we structure this? But yes, that was the original idea, and certainly Kusama should have. I think actually the original proposition was that this 1% of DOT, this like a million DOT, million old DOT, 100 million. Is that right? No. 100,000 old DOT, yes.
Okay.
100,000 DOT, old DOT, 10 million new DOT would be there to incentivize participation within Kusama. And I think the basic level of that would just be hand it to the Kusama Treasury.
Okay, well, that'll be wild. I hear the bridge is coming.
The bridge is indeed on its way.
Nice.
So, like, I think that there's... I definitely am one to... That believes that a DAO should be run, with fiscal responsibility, with financial responsibility, and part of that is minimizing this very volatile nature of crypto by doing what any rational
organization or individual would do with their assets, which is, you know, diversifying to some degree. I think there is, I don't know if anyone's making this argument, but, you know, an argument, a bunk argument would be, well, you know, this is Polkadot. You know, why would Polkadot want to hold anything other than dot tokens? Because it believes in itself, right? It's like nonsense. It's like, of course, Polkadot, if Polkadot is being reasonable, then of course it would want to hold. It doesn't live in a vacuum, right?
Of course,
it lives in an industry and wider. It lives in the wider world.
Yeah.
Of course it would want to hold other assets. It might want to hold gold. It might want to hold a basket of real fiat currencies. It might want to hold other cryptocurrencies. It might want to hold NFTs. It might want to hold oil or other commodities.
Land.
It could want to hold, I don't know, buildings or companies, right? Of course it wants to hold lots of diverse things in order to... because it's a, if it wants to build a well-functioning, long-lived organization, it needs to protect itself against volatility. I think we're getting there with, and the fellowship is a notable trendsetter here. I think in that it's attempting as a decentralized entity to score tokens that are not native to its platform.
Yeah.
And this will help. Manage volatility.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to see how that goes, but I think this is the sort of thing that I think just has to happen. I've talked about it a bit, in the old days, 2017, 18, 19. So I'm kind of excited to get this in and see how it works. I think it particularly makes sense with Polkadot's and Kusama's treasuries, given that we are funding things that are paid out in fiat.
Yeah.
Therefore, just makes so much sense to have that fiat up front and manage it like a real asset. Question is how to manage it, of course, and if you do it like too openly, then the market, end up with like market people front running and all the rest of it.
Right.
Probably has to be some clever way of managing this long term when we're talking about a large amount of capital. But in the short term, I think it's easy enough just to use Hydra DX or whatever.
Yeah, so cool. Gavin, I've loved talking to you. It's been so awesome. I think a role that a lot of people don't normally see you in, I mean, we see you as the architect of Polkadot, we see you as the leader of a movement, a harbinger of new technology that's changing the world, but you're also a father, and one day you're going to leave a world behind to your children and to everybody coming up after you.
Mm.
What do you hope that world looks like, and how do you hope your contributions to this technology contribute to that world?
I mean, I would hope that there is a world to start with,
okay.
Right?
Okay, fine.
So, ideally quite a peaceful one.
Yeah.
And ideally a just one. And I think in large part, that's what drives me here. I see power centers as the as maybe the underlying source of injustice in the world.
Mm.
Where you have arbitrary power, injustice seems not far behind.
Mm.
And so, creating power systems, which is really what blockchains are. They govern large amounts of wealth, large amounts of power that are rules-based and transparent, seems to me to be a great systematic way of reducing injustice in the world. Simply, basically, by limiting arbitrary power.
Hmm.
The other sort of companion point, I suppose, is that there's, and maybe something where I feel like I contribute fairly well is in devising the rules for these systems. Like even in societies that follow their rules fairly well, if the rules are not well designed, then the societies will not function very well, and they can even. If the rules, like nothing stops rules from being unjust or facilitating injustice. At the end of the day, the rules need to be need to be simple enough for people to be able to think about them and ideally reason them from first principles, and to be able to check to make sure that the rules are indeed being followed by the sort of parts of the social machinery that are meant to be following the rules, the civil servants or the politicians or the machines that may take over their jobs. And so the designing of like good rules-based systems, I think, is going to become a very crucial part of, I mean, it's already a crucial part of civilization, but like I think it's going to be an even more crucial part of civilization as these systems become more sophisticated. I kind of, the drive to like design good rules-based systems is something that sort of keeps my passion going.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your commitment and your focus. Thank you for sticking around and seeing the vision through. I'm sure there's many opportunities for you to just fuck off somewhere, but clearly you're here to build something important. Thank you very much for coming on the show as well. We really appreciate you sharing your story with us. Hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Cheers, Jay. Thanks for inviting me back on. It's been a pleasure.